Welcome back to part three of our three-part series with Daniel Schmachtenberger on the generator function of existential risks. In this episode, Daniel shares his vision for a path towards a post-existential risk future and the three key features of this new civilization design. He also talks about why there is no place for incentives in such a world.
To get all the links and show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/57. You can also find the first and second part of this interview there.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a premium nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and brain health. It's specifically designed to promote focus, support energy, mental clarity, mood, memory, and creativity. Yuvi and I have both used it in the past. We really like it, and we actually met the founders and interviewed them on Future Thinkers. And you can check out those interviews. They're one of our favorites at futurethinkers.org/Daniel and futurethinkers.org/Jordan. They've got a new formula up called Qualia Mind. It's got more natural ingredients, and you can get it at futurethinkers.org/brainhack, and you can get 10% off if you use the code FUTURE.
All right, let's get into the show.
Hey, and welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvi Ivanova.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
Upgrade your mental operating system, increase your personal sovereignty, and gain deeper self-knowledge with our courses in personal evolution. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media. I'm reading Carl Jung right now, and he's talking about his experience of going to live with the Pueblo Indians and how it completely just blew apart his conception of what was natural and how the Western worldview is different from other worldviews. And he noticed that they were so happy and serene, and they felt themselves as one with their environment, and they had this very special relationship with the sun, and it was very beautiful. But at the same time, he realized how they were very vulnerable to, you know, the invasion of the Western civilization. So if we create a new civilization operating system that is not oriented towards winning wars, then how do we ensure that it doesn't get destroyed by those who are?
Imagine there's a group of people that get a stronger theory of causation. So they learn Newton's physics, and so now they can use calculus to plot a ballistic curve and make the cannonball hit the right spot every time, rather than the pendulum dowsing, which is kind of a hit or miss. That belief is going to catch on. And that's why science really caught on, took us out of the Dark Ages, was because it led to better weapons and better agriculture tech and better, like, real shit. So it proliferated because it was proliferative. If we increase our theory of causation, that ends up catching on. But if we could increase our theory of causation and our theory of choice and the relationship between them, that would actually be the most adaptive, especially in the presence of where our particular game theoretic model of choice with the extension of causation we have is definitely self-terminating, definitely anti-adaptive. And so I know we've been on for a long time, so there's really only one more thing that I want to share that kind of closes this set of concepts. So remember we said that any source of asymmetric advantage, competitive advantage in a win-lose game will end up, once it's deployed, being figured out and utilized by everybody. You just up the level of ante in the playing field. So, but we also said that Indians you were just mentioning and many of the tribes we've mentioned lost win-lose games. We don't want to try and build something that's just going to lose at a win-lose game. But we know that if it tries to win at win-lose games, it's just still part of the same existential curve that we're on. So it has to not lose at a win-lose game while also not seeking to win. But do it. So it's basically not playing the game, but it is oriented about how not to lose. This is a very important thing. And so we can think about power the way we have traditionally thought of power as a power over or power against type dynamic, a game theoretic win-lose dynamic. And that any agent that deploys a particular kind of power leads to other agents figuring out how to deploy the same and other kinds of power. Power keeps anting up till we get to problems. But we could think about another term we might call strength, which is not the power to beat someone else, but it's the ability to not be beat by someone else. It's the ability to maintain our own sovereignty and our own coherence in the presence of outside forces. And so we could talk about my power, like, can I go beat somebody up? But my strength is, can my body fend off viruses? And can I fend off cancers? And can I actually protect myself if I need to protect myself, which is different than can I go beat other people up? And now the power game is the game we actually have to cure. power over dynamics mean rivalrous dynamics mean win-lose dynamics is the source of evil. It's not that money is the source of evil. It's that power over, where I think my well-being is anti-coupled to yours, ends up being the source of evil. And money is just very deep in the stack of power dynamics. But statuses and certain ways of relating to sex and a number of things are. So we have to get rid of the power over dynamics. But it doesn't mean that I can't develop strength that makes me anti-fragile in the presence of rivalry. And then I say, well, what kind of capacity can I develop that doesn't get weaponized by somebody else and used against me, given that any asymmetric capacity I get can be weaponized? There's really only one, and this is a really interesting thing. If I make the adaptive capacity of, say we're trying to make a new civilization as a model, and a new full stack civilization, new economics, new governance, new infrastructure, new culture, that has comprehensive loop closure, right? Doesn't create accumulation or depletion, doesn't have rivalrous games within it, et cetera. If I try to have some unique adaptive capacity via a certain type of information tech, the other world will see that information tech and use it for all kinds of purposes, including against me where there's an incentive to do so. And the same is true if I use military tech or if I use environmental extraction tech. Now, I'm still in the same problems. But if my advantage, the advantage of the way the civilization structured has to do with increased coherence in the sense-making and choice-making between all the agents in the system, all the people in the system, increased interpersonal coherence, this cannot be weaponized. And anyone else employing it is now just the system itself propagating. So, for instance, when we start playing rivalrous games, we start realizing that it's not just us against somebody else, it's teams against larger teams, right? And so then the idea of the team is we're supposed to cooperate with each other to compete against somebody else. But compete against someone else idea ends up going fractal, and I end up even competing against my teammates sometimes. And that's part of that why the collective intelligence doesn't scale thing, is because I'll cooperate with my other buddies on the basketball team unless there's also a thing called most valuable player. And I'm in the running for it, and I have a chance to make the three-point shot rather than pass, even though it decreases the chance of the team winning. Now I have a incentive misalignment. So I might go for that. And then it gets bigger where there's a couple of us that both want the same promotion to the same position at the company. And we're actually going to try and sabotage the other one, even though that harms the company, because my own incentive is not coupled with their incentive and with the company. And then I can look at, say, a couple different government agencies that are competing for the same chunk of budget. They will actually seek to undermine each other so they get more of the budget when they're supposed to be on the same team called that country. And so what we realize is we get this thing called, you know, like fractal disinformation, fractal decoherence and defection happening everywhere. And that creates the most broken information ecology and the least effective coordination and cooperation possible. And that's everywhere, right? That's ubiquitous. And it's the result of that underlying rivalry. So as we mentioned before, now, if I have some information, I want to make it to where nobody else can use it. I'm going to trademark it, patent it, protect my intellectual property. And before I've released it, I actually want to disinform everybody else about it, right? Tell them the gold is somewhere else so that they go dig in somewhere else and don't pay attention to what I'm doing. So if I am both hoarding information, disinforming others, and keeping my information from being able to be synthesized with others, that means I'm going to not let my knowledge about cancer research and whatever it is be out there because I got to make the pharma money back. So the best computer that the world could build doesn't exist because Apple has some of the IP, but Google has some of the IP, and 10 other companies have some of the IP. And so the best computer that science knows how to build can legally not be built in this world. And the best phone and the best car and the best medicine and the best every fucking thing there is, because we keep the actual adaptive knowledge from synthesizing, let alone that everybody is having to reproduce the same fucking work because we don't want to share our best practices. And then almost all the budget is going into marketing against the other ones rather than actual development. And the marketing's just lying. Manipulation, you know, at least about why ours is comprehensively better when they then have to say the same thing about what their IP does that's good and our IP does some other thing. Now imagine if we had a world where all the IP got to be synthesized. Nobody was disinforming anybody else. Nobody was sabotaging anyone else. Everyone was incented to share all of the info. And to synthesize all the info, to synthesize all of the intellectual property ideas, et cetera, work towards the best things possible, imagine how much more innovation would actually be possible, how much more collective intelligence and capacity would actually be possible. Now, if our source of adaptive advantage is that, right, is we make a world where, and now we have to come back to, we were talking about, if you possess a good and I no longer have access to it, we're in a rivalrous relationship. Right, you possess a piece of information and that I don't then get to have access to. We're in a rivalrous information of knowledge, et cetera. But if you have access to something and we've structured the nature of access where we have engineered the scarcity out of the system such that your having access doesn't make me not have access, and you having access leads to you being a human who has a full life, and some of your full life is creativity and generativity. And so now not only do you have the full access to those transportation resources, but also maker studios and art studios and education and healthcare and all the kinds of things that would make you a healthy, well-adaptive, creative person. And every well-adapted person is creative because nobody wants to just chill out watching TV all the time unless they were already broken by a system that tried to incent them to do shit that nobody wants to do, or if they can get a way out, they will, but they're a broken person. But if someone was supported in an education system to pay attention to what they were innately fascinated in and facilitate that, they'll all become masterful at some things with innate intrinsic motivation to do those things. And so now in a world where we support everybody to have access to the things that they are intrinsically incented to want to create, which if right now I get status by having stuff, but if we are engineering scarcity of the system, everyone has access. Nobody possesses any of it. Everybody has access to all of it. There's no status of having things and it's totally boring. There's no differential advantage. The only way you get status, the only way you get to express the uniqueness of who you are is by what you create. And so now the whole system's oriented towards that, but you don't create something to get money because money for what? To have access to shit you already have access to. But because you get to be someone who created that thing in both your own intrinsic experience of it and extrinsically getting to offer to the world and world recognize that. So now we have a situation where we all have access to Commonwealth resources that create an anti-rivalrous relationship to each other. And obviously, I'm just speaking about this at a 100,000-foot level, and we could drill down on what the actual architecture looks like, but there is actual architecture here that is viable, that meets the design criteria. And we have sense-making processes where we look at what a good design would be before making a proposition for a design that don't lead to polarization and radicalization, but that lead to progressively better synergistic satisfiers that get us out of theory of trade-offs and into, right, synergistic satisfiers also as a way of having people be more unifiable and on the same team. Now, if I've got this world where its source of competitive advantage, if you want to call it that, is that it has obsoleted competition within itself, so it has real coherence, then not only is the quality of life there radically higher because the people don't feel lonely and they actually have creative shit to do and they aren't being used as instrumental pawns to some other purpose and et cetera, and the quality of life is better because they're actually making better medicine and better technology and better, et cetera, because of the ability for the IP to synthesize and the, you know, everything else. But this world can also out-innovate in really key ways, other places in the world. And so then rather than the rest of the world wanting to attack it, the world, it can actually say, here, we'll export solutions you want. And so the rest of the world starts to create a positive dependence relationship. And then the rest of the world says, shit, we want to be able to innovate. Why were they able to solve that problem we weren't able to solve? Well, because our guys were like sabotaging each other and their guys weren't sabotaging each other. And we say, great, here's the social technology we use. Now, as soon as they implement that, it's not being weaponized. That's just the world actually shifting. That's where this model actually becomes a new basin of attraction that the world starts flowing to. And so you have to do that. You create a prototype of a full stack civilization that is anti-rivalrous, that is anti-fragile against rivalry, strength, not power, and that is auto-propagating, that by the nature of the solutions that it is exporting and by its own adaptive capacity, its own design starts to get implemented other places. And that's ultimately the desire. That is a path to a post-existential risk world, which is building it in prototype in a way where it auto-propagates.
That's so exciting.
Are there places where these prototypes are being built?
Kind of, but not really. There are intentional communities where people are trying to practice some things that they feel will be relevant. A closed loop agriculture system, right? Where they at least have regenerative agriculture and maybe some kinds of social coherence technologies where they have a better system of conflict resolution than our current judicial system, better parenting, better education. Like, we have those things, and those are cool and they're valuable, but they still have to buy their computers from Apple and fly on a Boeing to get somewhere that depends upon environmental destruction and war. And so they can't actually provide a high-tech civilization. So they're not yet civilization models. And the civilization models are all part of this one dominant civilization model. So this is a next endeavor. And before a full-stack civilization occurs, obviously partial ones, but that are directed towards a full-stack civilization have to occur. Because in the world we're talking about, there is no place for the things currently called judges or lawyers or politicians or bankers, because those systems don't exist. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't a equivalent of a judicial system, but it's totally fucking different from the level of the theory of ethics to the jurisprudence. And somebody has to be getting trained in the civics of that system. And there's nothing like banking, but there are things like paying attention to how the accounting of this new economy works. But people have to be trained in that. I'll give you one for instance. If we think about the physical economy, so we'll take attention out and just look at physics. We see that there's at least three different kinds of physics involved in the materials economy that are fundamentally different in their math. So there is a physics of atoms, physical atoms. There is a physics of energy, and there's a physics of bits. And right now, those are all fungible. I can use the same dollar to buy software or to buy energy or to buy metals or physical stuff, right? Food. But there's a fixed number of atoms of a certain type on the planet that are reasonably accessible. And right now, we're just taking them from the environment in a way that causes depletion and then putting them back into the environment as waste in a way that causes accumulation, toxicity on both sides. We can't keep doing that. We have to close loop it where we have then a give or take finite amount of metals, and not just metals, but hydrocarbons, everything, a finite amount of atoms that are in a closed loop relationship, but that can be upcycled because we have the energy to upcycle them, which means putting the same atoms into higher pattern where the pattern is evolving, the pattern stored in bits. So if I take the atoms out of one battery, put it in a new battery, what's evolved is battery technology. That new battery is in bits, a blueprint. And I'm going to use energy to take the atoms in the current form, disassemble them, and reassemble them into this new battery. And so there's a fixed amount of atoms. We have to close loop those. There's not a fixed amount of energy. We get new energy from the sun every day. But we have kind of a finite bandwidth of how much we get. So we have to operate within, that's not closed loop, right? We can use that up and it has entropy. But within that bandwidth, we have to work. And then bits are fundamentally unlimited, limited only by the compute of the energy and matter. So that can keep, you know, expanding basically indefinitely. Once I've made a bit, I can reproduce it exponentially without any unit cost. Because I can reproduce it exponentially without unit cost once I've developed it once, I can get exponential returns on software in a way that I could never get on atomic stuff, which is why Elon has a hard time raising money for physical stuff and WhatsApp sold for $19 billion. It's why all the unicorns are software, and mostly social tech or fintech or something that is actually doing not good things for the world, but can create exponential returns. And it's why Silicon Valley has basically mostly just invested in software stuff. If you make those fungible, you'll actually be moving the energy away from the atom and away from the energy into the virtual, away from the physical into the virtual, even though the virtual depends on the physical. So you're actually debasing the substrate upon which it depends. And so you notice that since the bits we can keep having more of forever, they don't go through an entropic degradation when we use them. The energy we can use, it entropically degrades, but we get more of it every day. And the atoms don't entropically degrade, but we have to keep cycling them and there's a fixed number. The physics, the accounting of those are totally different. That's not one economy that's fungible to itself with one accounting system. That's three completely separate but interacting physical economies. And now, again, we already said we're not owning goods. We're having access to shared commonwealth services. But this is just, for us to really go into it, it's a lot of things. But these are examples of some of the considerations that have to happen to actually be able to think about things like economics at a level of depth that is appropriate to the nature of the issues. If we don't answer the question of what makes a good civilization, and we simply say what allows civilization to endure, and so we start with, let's just say we don't want existential catastrophic risk. And there's a whole bunch of different types of existential catastrophic risks that all have the same generator function. So we have to create categorical solutions to the generator functions. It turns out that those are the generator functions that have made all the things that we intuitively have experienced as sucking, like violence and environmental devastation. And that solving those generator functions doesn't just allow us to survive in maybe some dystopian dynamic. Anti-rivalrous dynamics with each other and closed-loop dynamics and the proper relationship between the complicated and the complex, scalable collective intelligence systems, and a right understanding and theory of choice and relationship with theory of causation end up being a way of mapping to a world that is definitely protopic on any meaningful definition of protopy and any meaningful kind of consideration of what good could mean. And so when we come back to this mythopoetic, we can't keep going the way that we're going. There's a purgatory coming and it's going to go one way or the other. And one way is really shitty and one way is really lovely. That's a true story. And Bucky Fuller said utopia or oblivion, and it's going to be hit or miss till we're actually there. We're not going to know which way it goes. That's the thing I would just kind of end on is what it takes. If we try to solve the various risks in isolation, it's impossible. We fail. If what it takes to solve them categorically ends up also mapping to how we engage everyone in creating the true, the good, and the beautiful that is theirs to create progressively better, both upregulating their sense making of what that is with themselves and with each other and being able to make that, scaling the collective intelligence that is progressively answering those questions better.
Can you leave us with some book recommendations for anyone who wants to read up on this a little more and expand their understanding?
Books or other resources?
Yes, I wish I could share more things than I can, but a lot of what we're thinking in terms of new civilization design like this is new. Doesn't mean it's not drawing on lots of elements. So a couple things. We mentioned Jeffrey West's work, Scale, on collective intelligence. That's very valuable. We talked about some of the dynamics of game theory that have to shift. And so Finite and Infinite Games is just my favorite starting point. And it's one of the types of books that is very simple, but has multiple levels of depth of meaning that if you read it multiple times, you'll gain new insights.
Yeah, that one blew my mind.
Yep, me too.
James Carse, very beautiful. And, you know, I have a blog, civilizationemerging.com, that has some articles and these types of topics. And there's also a book list there with a heap of books.
Great.
Great.
Awesome. This, as always, is enlightening and so fun.
You know, there are books that are valuable, and there's obviously, like, all of your podcasts are valuable. If you had the experience of anything that I said making sense and actually seeming obvious, but then you also realize you never thought it in that particular way, then there's a question, why did I never think it in that way, even though it seems obvious after the fact? And that's one of the principles that clarity, one of the properties that clarity has, is it can add novel insight, but that seems obvious and kind of prima facie relates to everything that we know. But when you say, okay, I wasn't thinking about rivalrous dynamics and upping the ante clearly enough. I wasn't thinking about the exponential economy and software and atoms all being fungible, like there's a problem there. I wasn't thinking about open loops, closed loops in this particular way. But you can, if you start just asking for yourself, what do I think is actually wrong? And then of all the things that seem wrong, what do they have in common? And why are those things that are wrong, wrong? What is going on? And then go deeper. Keep going deeper with that. And don't look for one answer. Are there a number of different things that come together that are partial answers to this? And what would solving that look like? And there are resources of other people's thinking on these things, but they won't replace, they will inspire, but they won't replace your own deep thinking on these things for your own sense-making. And so the resource that I would offer the most is when you are bothered by something, or you wish some beautiful thing existed more than it does, really think hard about why things are the way they are. And know that the first thoughts you will come up with are not that good. But if you stop, you won't get beyond there. But if you really keep working on it and thinking about it and then going and researching in light of that question and then thinking about it more, you actually start to get novel and meaningful and deeper sense-making that is aligned with what is yours to pay attention to and work on.
To relate to what you said earlier, I think it really helps to use different modes of inquiry. People can get stuck in just intellectual inquiry or just spiritual inquiry. but you know, all are valuable. And when we can see the same thing from several different perspectives, it becomes a 3D object rather than just being flat.
You just actually mentioned one of my favorite practices is really endeavoring to see and experience the world through the perspective of someone else and actually see and experience it. And if I'm still thinking, no, if I was in their position, I wouldn't do that. I haven't got it yet. Because if I was in their position, I would do it. If I'm really putting myself in a position, I would get enraged by the things they're enraged by. I would get excited by the things they're excited by. And so this both as a practice of empathy and connection, as a practice of understanding, as a practice of intelligence and learning, because I see different things. If I look at the world through the lens of a mechanical engineer, I see shit everywhere that mechanical engineers see that you never saw, which is different than if you look through the lens of a fashion designer, where you look through the lens of, you know, a game theory person. They're looking at different things, or an evolutionary biologist, and you're like, whoa, there's a whole universe I wasn't paying attention to. Like when you buy the car and you see it everywhere, you put on a lens and you start seeing all kinds of stuff. You factor the sense making. But also as a kind of spiritual technology of getting out of the default mode of what you think you are. And when I'm trying to be someone else, it's not my personality that can do that. If I'm trying to take their personality on, it's not my perspective that can do it. It is the same consciousness that's witnessing my perspective that can then witness somebody else's. And as soon as I do that, I actually dissociate from just being my personality. And then I get some more spaciousness around it. I'm less reactive by it.
And this also relates to not just looking through the lens of different personalities or different modern frameworks. It's also looking through the lens of pre-modern frameworks or even animal frameworks. And that can all be very useful as well, because if we look at the world through the lens of quote unquote primitive tribe, then different things come into focus and different things become very meaningful and very powerfully meaningful. Like it resonates through your whole being, just, you know, wow. And that's not to be dismissed, because there's something there. I mean,
at the very minimum for self-discovery, it's super useful, because, you know, we've spent more time as those primitive versions of ourselves than we have the modern versions. And you can kind of untie a lot of behaviors that you don't really realize you have based off of just looking at the world from a primitive standpoint.
Well, if your peer has some people decide to go visit the Amazon and live with a tribe and experience the world too, those eyes and be affected by it, and then look at how they can incorporate elements of that experience of the world and their previous experience of the world to being able to live more fully. That would be beautiful. Daniel, this was wonderful. I really appreciated being here with you both. And I really do want to say that I love your podcast and I love what you're creating, both of you together. It's very easy to have well-informed dystopian views. And it's easy to not think about things, or it's easy to have poorly informed positive views. But to have well-informed positive views is actually tricky, because if we keep being anything like the kinds of people that we have always been, that do really wonderful and really atrocious shit with our power, but having exponentially more power, they're all dystopian scenarios. And so we have to be something really different than we've ever been, which requires some type of deep shifts that could make that happen. That requires some deep thinking, right? Some deep imagination. And I know that's what you are really dedicated to doing here on the show. I'm reminded of this quote from the book of Romans. It says, "The pathway to heaven is narrow and steep, and the pathway to hell is wide and many." And it's kind of just like a way of thinking about thermodynamics, which is that there's just more ways to break shit than to build it. There's like not that many ways this all the cells in your body can come together that make you. With the emergent property of you, there's a lot of ways that you just get like 150 pounds of goo. And so we say like, okay, we got a lot of power, and most of those scenarios with a lot of power suck. How could we have this much power that doesn't suck? How could we have this much power and not use it against each other? And we start seeing Orwell and control systems. And we start seeing, oh, that sucks too. And to keep thinking through, how could we have it that doesn't suck? And I can't depend on aliens or Jesus. What, coming back, like, how do we get us to be that kind of consciousness? It's a really good way of thinking about how to actually address these problems. Because if we can't, you know, Voltaire's without vision, man perishes. If we can't even see a well-grounded positive future and positive use of the technological capacity we have, we are not going to make it. And so I love that you all have this space dedicated to exploring that topic. Incentive is always evil. It's a bitch. So I don't want to move from perverse incentive to positive incentive. Positive incentive means my sense making has determined what I think is good, and I'm going to try and extrinsically override your sense making to make a choice aligned with my sense making. I'm going to use a extrinsic reward strategy to co-opt your sovereignty and have your choice making be based on my sense making incentive schema rather than your own sense making. And that is always the basis of evil. If I want to have a collective intelligence that's actually intelligent, I need everyone to have intrinsic sense-making and choice-making that is uncorruptible, which means it's not being co-opted by extrinsic reward and punishment schemas. I got this wrong at first. I used to say we have to create a world where the incentive of every agent is rigorously aligned with the well-being of every other agent and of the commons. That is wrong. What is right is to say that we must rigorously remove any place where the incentive of an agent is misaligned with the well-being of other agents in the commons. But an adequate future is one that has no system of structural incentive.
Oh, that's a mind blower.
The cells in your body are actually not trying to get the other ones to do what they want them to do. They have their own internal sense-making processes, and they do what makes sense to them. And what makes sense to them also happens to be what's good for the ones around them, because they depend on the ones around them and vice versa, and they're in a communication process. But the brain is not overriding the cells, and in no way could handle the complexity necessary of the cells not doing their own sense-making. And so better incentive schemas as a transition, which is happening in the blockchain, is nice. It's worse than more perverse incentives, but it is transitional, not post-transitional. It actually does not address existential risk. It doesn't give us the right collective intelligence. The right collective intelligence has to be fractal sovereignty, meaning at the level of an individual and every group size, it has its own intact sense-making and choice-making that ends up being vectoring towards omni-consideration. The level of shift that we're talking about is hard to imagine.
Yeah. And what has to be invented to even begin a transition and then be put to rest so that the next version can come along is such a long road.
The reason that we incent people is because we have a civilization that needs a lot of shit done that is not fun. It's dreadful stuff. So we want to get the people to do the dreadful stuff. If we created a commonwealth where everyone had access to resources, then nobody would do the dreadful stuff. And so then the state would have to force them. That's why we don't like communism. Then you get the state imperialism. So we say, okay, cool. We'll let the free market force them instead. It's economic servitude, but at least that doesn't look like somebody did it, because the market is the just anonymous thing, right? If you don't do the shitty job, you're homeless and your kids can't eat. Cool. But we'll tell you the story that you can work your way up and, you know, become wealthy, even though statistically we know that it's silly. It happened to those two guys that one time. Even though statistically the rest of the time, having more resources makes it easier to make more resources, and having less resources makes it harder to make more resources. And so the system has a gradient that makes it actually continue in the direction of inequality, not the, you know, otherwise. But so that's where incentive came from, right? That's the good side. The negative side is a few controlling a many want to use incentive, reward and punishment. And to get people to do the shitty things, we have to do that. This is using choice to create a system of causation. Incentive is a causal system. Game theory is a causal system to control the choice of others, control or co-op. I want to have my theory of choice affect causal dynamics that are only causal, i.e. if I make an automated robot, I haven't actually made a sentient being a utility. So I'm going to say something even deeper, which is instrumental relationships are evil.
Can you expand that?
Yeah. If I'm interacting with you to meet some people that you know to get my network ahead, or to get some knowledge from you, or to gain access to something, or to whatever it is, I have something that I want to do that you are an instrument towards, you are a path towards, it's a utilitarian ethic, then you are a ends to a means for me. So however I relate with you, however it affects your own sovereign sentient experience, is a place I might externalize harm, because it's not why I'm relating with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in a healthy world, a world of the future, other people need to have intrinsic value, independent of utilitarian value to everyone. That's a part of the culture. And not just the other people and other beings, all kinds of sentient beings, but relationships have intrinsic value. So I'm going to invest in the integrity of our relationship independent of me getting anything out of it. Because it is actually the basis of meaningfulness itself, which is why in a utilitarian and instrumental dynamic, we're getting ahead while feeling utterly fucking meaningless and destroying everything that is meaningful in the process. That is us being hooked to addiction to a stupid game where what we think we want is not what we actually want. And what we think of as a win is actually a omni-stupid thing. And this is why, you know, like the Hindu concept of dharma was a virtue ethic, not a utilitarian ethic. And there was a very meaningful set of concepts of do what is inherently right in your relationship with life, independent of what the outcome might be, because you really don't know what the fucking outcome is going to be. And if you try and just figure out what the outcome is going to be, you're going to be wrong a lot of times, and you're also going to justify a lot of unethical stuff. And utilitarianism is kind of the rampant ethics that anyone who's paying attention to ethics pays attention to right now. And it's not without any merit, but it is also problematic. It is up there with democracy and capitalism, you know, and the philosophy of science in terms of being a problematic thing to be the dominant system, because we cannot actually predict in complex systems well enough to do a utilitarian thing. And the intrinsic dynamics of a relationship and another being end up becoming moved to being a means to an ends other than them. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I start factoring everything meaningful along the chain of whatever I think my outcome is, to where my outcome is actually being in a way that is in integrity with an honoring of all life, now it's a virtue ethic.
Yeah. I was having this conversation recently about people who are obsessed with life hacking and optimizing everything. And when they get into that mindset, eventually they get to what they call optimizing relationships. And then they start putting people on a value hierarchy where they want to interact with high value people and they want to get a high value woman. And they're using these tactics to find and attract the most high value woman. And it's funny because those people, in my experience, are some of the most existentially unhappy people that I've met. And they will never demonstrate it outward in an outward way. But that's what I've noticed, that, you know, people who try to optimize everything in this kind of utilitarian way end up really profoundly unhappy.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing as continuously pursuing a better high. It's I'm getting a hit from winning at a particular thing, so I got to try and win at it all the time. But I need the hit because my baseline is that life feels fucking meaningless because I don't actually have any real relationships and I don't even know what meaning means. I don't even know what intimacy means. And so that hyponormal environment needs a hypernormal stimuli to feel anything. And then the fact that I use people instrumentally has people end up not liking me, which makes me hurt even more, which makes me want another hit even more.
People like you make it super easy. You just come on and it's like we listen to audiobooks all day and then we get to actually talk to the person who's coming up with the cutting edge ideas themselves. So it's quite interesting. Thank you.
Bye, y'all.
Yeah, it's always wonderful getting our brains blown by you. Thank you.
Thank you both. This was really fun.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
Upgrade your mental operating system, increase your personal sovereignty, and gain deeper self-knowledge with our courses in personal evolution. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.